The meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Retirement Savings, we're in session. I'd like to start by asking for a moment of silence, just to think about the good people in the Reynolds School District, the kids, the families, the administrators, and others that are impacted by today's events. Thank you. Today we are going to take a look at the Employment Retirement Income Security Act, otherwise known as ERISA. We've got a couple of experts who have very kindly agreed to share their thoughts with us. The reason we're delving into ERISA is that the legislation that was passed that helped create this panel also stipulated that we would create no liabilities for the state under ERISA. And so that, to me, signaled that we better understand what ERISA is. And so we've got a couple of great people on the phone. We've got Judy Owens and Bill. Is it pronounced Perron?
Perron,
yes. They're here.
Well, that's really good reception. They've really improved the phones over the years. On the phone, then, is who?
Susan Reese and Joe Canary.
Okay, and Hillary is... Hillary Dukes is also. Okay, great. Susan Reese, Joe Canary from the Washington, D.C. office. And we very much appreciate your taking the time to help inform us. So without further ado, we'll jump right into ERISA. And I assume we'll do it in this order. Mm-hmm. Is that the easiest?
Bill and Judy can come up.
Perfect. Come on up. And if you could just state your name for the record, since we record these and a lot of legislators will want to hear what we're thinking about.
Hi, my name is Judy Owen. I'm the district supervisor for the Seattle Office of the Employee Benefits Security Administration.
Thanks, Judy.
And I'm Bill Perron. I'm supervisory benefits advisor for the Seattle District Office of the Employee Benefits Security Administration.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate you both being here very much.
We'd like to thank the task force and you, Treasurer Wheeler, for inviting us to testify today. I'm just going to give a very brief overview of our office and our function there, and then hand it over to Judy, who's going to get into more of the meat of the presentation about ERISA. So we both work for the Employee Benefits Security Administration in the Seattle District Office. Judy heads a team of investigators who handle ERISA enforcement issues. I supervise a team of benefit advisors who are the people who take your calls if you happen to call our 800 number and have a question about your benefits or your rights under the law. The Employee Benefits Security Administration is an agency of the United States Department of Labor. It's charged with enforcement of ERISA as well as related statutes that fall under ERISA. Those are mainly in the healthcare area, but there are also some pension statutes as well, things like HIPAA, COBRA, and various other laws. Our purpose here today is really to talk about what ERISA covers. How does ERISA coverage work? What sort of plans does it reach? What doesn't it reach? And we are here to give you that presentation. The folks who are on the phone are from our Office of Regulations and Interpretations, and that office in our national office is really responsible for coming up with the more definitive legally binding interpretations of ERISA and what it reaches. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Judy and let her get started.
Thank you.
All right, so I appreciate you calling us experts in the field of ERISA, although I don't personally claim to that. It is a very complex statute, as we are aware. That's why we have the three parties on the phone that we have here today. They are the experts in coverage, in particular, what constitutes a covered ERISA plan. Joe Canary is the author of advisory opinions that are on our public website. He and his staff are the ones that take the questions from various entities that ask whether or not they are a covered ERISA plan. So you'll see their advisory opinions published on their website, and they are the experts, and hopefully they'll jump in when questions are asked here. So Title I of ERISA is the part of ERISA that we enforce through the Department of Labor. Title I sets forth a lot of different provisions that must be met if you're an ERISA-covered plan. Primary among them are the fiduciary standards of conduct that are required of all the people managing, handling retirement plans and welfare benefit plans. There are certain prohibitions set forth in ERISA, what you cannot do as a fiduciary with ERISA plans. There are also requirements, just very broadly describing this, under Title I that deal with reporting and disclosure obligations, so that if you're an ERISA plan, you are likely required to file an annual report with the government, just for example. You have to provide certain disclosures to participants, to your employees that are participants in the employee benefit plans. There are also standards under Title I that or provisions under Title I that deal with other requirements such as eligibility, participation, vesting. So today, my understanding was you're primarily interested in dealing with what would cause a plan to be a covered plan under ERISA. So that's what we're limited to today.
But before you jump into that, can I get clarification on a really basic point? Somebody could help me. So the legislation said that the task force cannot put forth any recommendations that would subject the state of Oregon or private employers to responsibilities under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. So am I assuming that to mean that we don't want to be an ERISA-compliant plan? Or am I assuming that to be the opposite? What is the intention here?
You're asking those of us who actually voted on it?
Because there's two wildly different interpretations of what that could mean. And I'm just trying to figure out, I've been asking this question since we convened, which it is. So for future reference, I think we need to clarify the legislative intent on that very basic and important issue. That won't impact your presentations today, but I just want you to know I still have that question.
Is it possible that the answer to some of that depends on what we learn about what defines an ERISA plan from our speakers?
Maybe.
We'll try and give you an overview.
So, Chair Wheeler, can you read that one more time?
Sorry?
Can you just read that one more time?
The task force cannot put, and this is a paraphrasing of the legislation. This is not the language. The task force cannot put forth any recommendations that would subject the state of Oregon or private employers to responsibilities under ERISA. So when you say to be ERISA compliant, there are disclosure and reporting requirements. What I'm trying to figure out from the legislation perspective is, are you saying that they don't have to comply or provide disclosures, or are we saying that they will, but they'll do so in a way that doesn't put them in violation with ERISA? I could read that either way.
Yeah.
Right? So I just think we need clarification on that for future reference. Sorry,
no.
I digress.
So we're talking about what it means to be an ERISA-covered plan. Once you are an ERISA-covered plan, then you are required to be an ERISA-compliant plan.
And Dick
has
made a good point. It's plans or products.
Plans or products. Well, we are limited to what is defined as an employee benefit plan, which are plan, funds, or programs to provide certain stipulated benefits under Title I of ERISA. So we'll get into that a little bit.
So there is no such thing as a product that is either in compliance or in violation of ERISA?
Not under Title I.
Okay.
It's a plan,
good.
Fund.
See, we've already gotten somewhere. That part of the legislation we have now resolved. Check the box and move on.
So there are exemptions from coverage under ERISA, governmental plans being foremost among them, so we'll get to that as well. But that may be what your question was kind of getting towards. To be covered under ERISA, it is any employee benefit plan that is established or maintained by an employer, by an employee organization, or both, that are engaged in commerce or are engaged in industries or activities affecting commerce. That's it. And then each of those pieces to that coverage definition are further defined either in the statute or through courts over time or through our advisory opinions. But that's what it takes to be a covered ERISA plan, is it's any employee benefit plan established or maintained by an employer or an employee organization or both that are engaged in commerce. So
does that definition, is it wide enough to include government?
An exemption from coverage is stipulated under Section 4A of ERISA, is that governmental plans are specifically excluded from coverage. And there are dozens of advisory opinions on what constitutes a governmental plan, but it's not defined in the statute.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead. There's various federal statutes that make reference to engaged in commerce depending on what business that agency is in. And under labor law, it means one thing, and other agencies, it might mean another. Do you have a specific definition related to ERISA that defines what it means to be engaged in commerce?
ERISA does define commerce, and it also defines industries or activities engaged in commerce, but it is very, very broadly defined, so that it would be hard pressed to find a business operating within the state of Oregon that is not engaged in commerce. And the definition of commerce is trade, traffic, commerce, transportation, or communications between any state and any place outside thereof. So if you are engaged in a business using the internet, phones, you are going to be engaged in commerce.
So there's no dollar limitation on the amount of engagement like there are under some other agencies and statutes?
No, there's not.
Okay.
Let me ask a question. Are you familiar with simple IRA plans for employees?
Yes.
Yeah. And do they fall under ERISA?
Yes, if they're established or maintained by an employer engaged in commerce.
I know the guidelines. Now, compensation plans to individuals of business, such as life insurance or whatever, those don't fall under ERISA.
That's a more complicated question than perhaps you're aware. But life insurance, ERISA, Title I of ERISA defines an employee benefit plan to be both a welfare benefit plan and a pension benefit plan. So under ERISA, if you are considered a welfare benefit plan, you are also covered by ERISA. And welfare benefit plan generally means health plans or medical plans, but it also reaches down to life insurance plans, disability in some ways, accidental death and dismemberment.
Dental plans, even a prepaid legal plan could be a welfare plan, as long as the employer has a group plan that covers employees.
So the key word here is group plan. If they discriminate, just choose out key employees, whatever, to provide a benefit to, it probably falls outside the guidelines. Group, being a group, in other words, makes the difference.
I can't answer that yes or no. I think it really would be facts and circumstances. We'd have to take a look at that.
This is Joe Canary. That would not be right. The employee benefit plan definition doesn't depend on the number of employees that are covered. You could have a plan that covers just one employee. There are special provisions in ERISA dealing with plans for select group of management or highly compensated employees, both on the pension plan and the welfare benefit plan sides.
I wanted to bring it out because I'm an insurance professional that's on the panel here. So,
okay.
Thank you.
So you could have a single policy covering just one employee, and that could be an employee benefit plan.
Yeah, I didn't mean to muddy the water by using the term group. It's really you have to have an employee, but as long as there's that employer-employee relationship.
Does self-employed count as having an employee?
Sorry. So... One of the to be an employee benefit plan, we're kind of jumping around, but that's fine. To be an employee benefit plan, if you don't cover, if the plan does not cover a common law employee, then it's exempt from Title I of ERISA. And that would traditionally be like a sole proprietorship where the plan covers the owner and his spouse, his or her spouse. And the other might be a partner. It would not cover those. Okay. It has to have a common law. The plan has to cover a common law employee in order to be covered by ERISA.
So this is my fault because I jumped in and interrupted you with the question.
Yeah.
Why don't we let them continue the presentation? Let's ask questions that are relevant to what they are presenting at that given time, and then let's write down questions that aren't for the end, and that way we can let you get through your testimony. Great. Thank you. It's my fault. It's not anybody else's.
Well, the definition of employee, so the employee covered under Title I is any employee benefit plan established or maintained by an employer or employee organization. So employer is defined in ERISA rather unhelpfully as anybody directly acting as an employer or indirectly in the interest of an employer, but it also includes groups or associations of employers. An employer association is not itself defined in ERISA, and it has been I don't know if you'd say defined, but through advisory opinions, there are certain facts and factors that have been weighed in to determine what's an employer association that would be considered an employer sponsor or maintaining an employee benefit plan. And those factors include how the members are solicited, who's entitled to participate, who actually participates in the association, the purpose for which it was the association was created. Basically, what we're looking for there is a commonality of interests amongst the employers. If there's a commonality of an interest, we consider it a bona fide employer association maintaining a plan. Regardless if it's a bona fide employer association, we could still find that the various members of that association, I'll back up, a bona fide employer association establishes a employee benefit plan, and we would look at that as one plan subject to ERISA. If it's not a bona fide employer association, nevertheless, all the adopting small employers, generally small employers that adopt this association plan are still, in our view, sponsoring or maintaining an employee benefit plan. So we might have 50 different ERISA plans as opposed to one. So I'm not sure it's relevant for your purposes, but that's an employer association is also considered an employer under ERISA. Employee organizations, the definition of an employee organization, our traditional look on that is unions. Labor unions are a traditional form of employee organization. You can also have employees beneficiary associations. Basically, these are an employee organization is an organization, association in which employees participate and with the purpose of dealing with the employers regarding the employee benefit plan or other matters incidental to employment. The big one, again, is labor unions. We talked about the definition of commerce a little bit. Let's skip ahead. So what constitutes an employee benefit plan? That is also defined in ERISA. As I mentioned, it can be an employee welfare benefit plan or it can be an employee pension benefit plan, both of which are also defined. An employee benefit plan is a plan, fund, or program established or maintained by an employer or employer organization, and which provides certain benefits enumerated under the statute, Title I. To be a welfare benefit plan, it provides health, medical, life. We talked about that a little bit. If you're a pension plan, you're providing either retirement income or deferral of income until termination of employment or beyond. If you fall into that definition, you may be offering an employee pension benefit plan that would be subject to Title I of ERISA. There is, when we talk about plan funds or programs, there's no particular formality required to have. If you're an employer offering a plan fund or program, once you're subject to Title I of ERISA, ERISA does require that plan to be in writing. But just the absence of a writing itself does not mean that your particular program of benefits isn't going to be considered to be an ERISA-covered plan. So you could inadvertently establish an employee benefit plan, pension plan, through the design of it. And the factors we look at to determine whether it's been really driven through the courts, but the factors we look at to determine whether you have a plan, fund, or program is what are the intended benefits from the arrangement, who are the intended beneficiaries, what's the source of financing, and is there a procedure to apply for and collect benefits. If a reasonable person can look at this arrangement and determine those kinds of factors, then you might find yourself with an ERISA-covered plan, whether or not you wanted one to begin with. Financing can be through multiple sources. It can be through, if we're talking about welfare benefit plan in particular, it can be through a trust fund, it can be through an insurance contract, it can be through simply payment of benefits out of the general assets of the employer if we're talking about a health plan or a welfare benefit plan. If you're a pension plan, it needs to be funded through a trust fund. The definition, so harking back to what it means to have an ERISA-covered plan, it is a plan, fund, or program established or maintained. And established or maintained is also not defined in ERISA, but it is key. It is what we look at to determine whether or not this particular arrangement is, in fact, an ERISA-covered plan. So what it means to be established or maintained, we look towards, again, the... You know, what are the intended benefits? Who are the beneficiaries? What's the source of financing? And is there a way to apply for and collect your benefits? With respect to governmental plans in particular, you'll see our advisory opinions looking at the source of funding. Is the funding coming from the government, at least in part? We look at the extent of the government entity's involvement in the administration of the plan itself. And if the government is providing the financing and or is heavily involved or involved in the administration of the plan, it could be considered a governmental plan exempt from ERISA.
This is Joe Canary again. Let me add one more thing to that. Governmental plans have to provide benefits to employees of the government. So even if the government is involved in a private sector plan, that would not make that a governmental plan.
Okay, that was my question.
All right.
So my understanding is you're primarily interested in retirement plans and not necessarily welfare benefit plans, right? So
correct.
So the type of benefit that could fall under the realm of being a retirement plan is basically a deferral of income beyond employment, termination of employment and beyond. So there are certain exemptions from that. I think the one that may be the one I'll talk about is tax-sheltered annuities, otherwise known as 403B plans, are offered by public schools, other tax-exempt organization nonprofits, certain ministers. They offer these tax-sheltered annuities. There are certain requirements. They have to be, you know, held by a custodial bank or a trust account. They have to be invested in mutual funds. But they are exempt from ERISA if they meet our regulation, which lays out a safe harbor for that. And essentially, if there are contributions from a private sector employer, then that 403B plan will be subject to ERISA, Title I of ERISA. If there are no employer contributions, then the safe harbor the safe harbor in the regulation could be germane. If under that safe harbor, if participation by the employees is voluntary, if the rights under the contract are enforceable solely by the employee and not the employer, if the employer involvement is limited, basically in terms of setting up the deferrals, And there's no compensation flowing back to the employer except for reimbursement of actual and reasonable expenses, then it could fall into this safe harbor under ERISA and it would not be a covered ERISA plan.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
As a point of fact, in Oregon, I've worked extensively with the 403B programs, and they changed dramatically with the came under the jurisdiction of ERISA, so the majority of larger school districts who could afford it have all gone to a third-party administrator for handling hardship provisions, loan provisions, and everything, which is probably a good thing. It took the burden off of the school districts not to make a mistake, just as a point of fact.
I'm going in the order of these slides, so forgive me, but there are two basic types of pension benefit plans. There are defined contribution plans, such as 401k plans, where the employees participate and where the amount of retirement income at the end of their employment is dependent on the returns from the investments for the defined contribution plan, as well as their own contributions and maybe employer matching. There are also defined benefit plans, which are entirely employer-funded through employer contributions. The investment risk is on the shoulders of the employer, and your retirement income is usually formula-driven. You know, your high five or high three times some formula of years of service. We'll talk about governmental plans now as an exemption from ERISA. As I mentioned, they're not defined under ERISA. They are defined under ERISA, Section 332. These are plans that are established or maintained for the government's employees, for its employees, by the U.S. government, a government of any state or political subdivision thereof, or any agency or instrumentality of any of the foregoing. What's not defined in ERISA is what it means to be an agency or an instrumentality of a government agency. I mean, that's not defined. So our Office of Regulations and Interpretation does receive a lot of requests to determine whether or not a plan is a governmental plan, and there are advisory opinions on our website dealing with that.
Can Joe just give an example of something just to help them?
Joe, do you have an example of a recent advisory opinion that you?
The advisory opinions are all posted on our website, and they're listed by year, so we can provide you with some samples of advisory opinions on governmental plan questions and give you the links to the website. We've been issuing advisory opinions really since the early 70s, so there's a fair number of advisory opinions on ERISA coverage questions generally, but also on governmental plan issues. So if you'd be interested in that, we can definitely supply that to you. Do you want to talk about an example of a governmental plan as opposed to a specific advisory opinion? Was that the question?
Yeah, I think it might help the task force have
better perspective. So, for example, the United States government, I'm an employee of the government. There are sort of pension plans and group health plans and life insurance plans that the U.S. government provides to its employees. That would be like the a classic example of a government plan. Most of the states, Oregon, California, Washington, have their own plans for their own employees. You can end up with municipalities or counties that then will also have their own plans for their own employees. Those would all be sort of typical governmental plans. It gets a little bit more complex when you get to the agency or instrumentality question. There may be sort of entities that are created by the government as an agency or instrumentality that are distinct from the municipality or the county or the state, and they may have their own employees and establish their own separate plan outside of the state or county system. If those enterprises are classified as agencies or instrumentalities of the state or political subdivision, they can establish their own plans. Public school districts sort of are a classic example of a type of governmental plan run by an agency or instrumentality of the state or the county, depending upon how the public school system is set up in the state. You can end up with the line getting a little bit ambiguous, where you're talking about quasi-public, quasi-private kind of enterprises, where there's a mixture of governmental involvement and private sector, and for this purpose, we would classify not-for-profit as being potentially in the private sector area. So you could have the government and a not-for-profit joining together to accomplish sort of a charitable, educational, social purpose. And depending upon the involvement of the governmental partner in that arrangement, you may then have an agency instrumentality as well, or it could fall on the private sector side if you have too little governmental control over the arrangement. There is not a regulation currently that defines a governmental plan, but the governmental plan definition in ERISA is essentially the same definition that's in the Internal Revenue Code for tax purposes. There's a similar definition in what's called Title IV of ERISA, which is administered by the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, and they are more directly regulating defined benefit pension plans. All the definitions are the same. The Internal Revenue Service currently has an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. It's kind of an unofficial way of communicating to the public that the IRS is thinking about issuing a regulation of a defined governmental plan and providing some specificity as to what they might propose as a regulation to try to get early public reaction. That thing called an ANPRM, or an Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, the Internal Revenue Service published one of those maybe a year and a half or so ago and has received a fair amount of public comment on that. In terms of a regulatory development, that's probably the leading edge. Most of the other definitional provisions are dealt with interpretively through advisory opinions, private letter rulings, things of that sort.
Thanks, Joe.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
I think that's probably enough.
Joe, could I ask a follow-up question? This is Ted.
Sure.
So the definitions I've heard suggest, and maybe I'm wrong, so please clarify this for me. Government plans aren't just, it's not just referring to who sponsors the plan government, it's also a reference to who is the beneficiary in the plan. Is that correct?
That's correct. We call them participants.
Participants, thank you.
It's the participants would be the employees, typically. They could be union members, but they also would typically be employees of the governmental entity. And the plan has got to have substantial governmental involvement. They can be collectively bargained, so you can have a union involved. But as you point out, the definition calls for the participants or beneficiaries, from your perspective, to be employees of the governmental entity or entities that are sponsoring the plan.
So I know I'm going to get asked this question. So if government, theoretically, were to create a plan, and the plan did not have public sector employees in it, but instead had private sector employees, it would then be subject to ERISA. Is that correct?
I think that's probably the question that you're going to be ultimately focused on trying to explore in some detail. There are other states that I think are engaged in exercises similar to what you're doing. California is probably the most well-publicized and maybe the one that's further along. But they are also looking at ways the government could provide some type of retirement savings vehicle or arrangement, especially for employees who do not have access to an ERISA-covered plan, as a way of improving retirement savings and retirement security issues for the people that the government represents. There's a variety of states on the East Coast that are also exploring the issue as well. And I think where you start from is where your questions in the presentation began. ERISA was enacted in 74 as a federal statute that was designed to provide a very broad definition of what's an employee benefit plan. At that time, there was not a uniform standard and protections, especially in federal law, for employee benefit plans, both pension and welfare group health plans. ERISA was designed to put that in place, and it has reporting and disclosure rules. It has fiduciary requirements regarding the administration of the plan, the handling of plan assets. It has coverage and participation requirements, especially for pension plans. More recently, it's been amended by the Affordable Care Act and other group health laws to provide enhanced protections and requirements for the group health marketplace. So over the course of time, it started as a very broad statute designed to provide protections, and the definition of employee benefit plan was similarly broad, so that when an employer was providing benefits to their employees, the presumption was ERISA would apply, and these requirements designed to make sure the plans were run properly and people's benefits were protected would be in place. As a element of that, when ERISA was enacted, the Congress put in a very broad ERISA preemption provision saying state laws that relate to employee benefit plans, and the word relate is in the statute, and it's not on its face that enlightening. But if the state law relates to an employee benefit plan, it would then be preempted. And that is, I think, the place where your examination is focused, to say, well, what can you do as a state to create additional retirement savings options where, and I know there's a question pending, but assuming that you did not want to create an ERISA-covered plan and you also wanted to avoid ERISA preemption. That is the examination that other states are engaged in, and I expect you have started it and probably will continue to get even more deeply into it.
Thank you.
So the short answer is, it depends.
We got that.
The states are really trying to figure out what space there is where they could either establish a retirement savings arrangement that is not an ERISA-covered plan, where the requirements would not be preempted by ERISA as to relate to the employers or insurance companies or banks or other people that are providing services to the arrangement, or alternatively trying to require the establishment of an ERISA plan and then operate that plan within the context of ERISA. Both of those endeavors present ERISA preemption challenges.
Got it. Thank you. That's an excellent answer. It's thorough, and I appreciate it. Anne, did you have a...
Sure, thank you.
Elena,
so it sounds like implicit in the structure of ERISA is that we were protecting against the idea that privately run, privately administered plans might be at greater risk of running into difficulty than would government.
I'm having a hard time hearing that speaker.
Okay. It sounds to me like our implicit understanding with ERISA is that privately run plans need to be subject to stricter scrutiny, and therefore ERISA, because of concerns, things will go awry, and so there's a carve-out for government-run ones on a presumption that those are more, that we feel more confident that those are going to be run with the best interest of the public in mind, and similarly, possibly for nonprofit-administered plans, maybe because the motives attributed there are somehow also thought to be, presumptively good. So I think that your point is interesting. You know, it sounds like a case of first impression about whether government-run plans for private, non-privately covered individuals falls within an exemption. But similarly, might nonprofit-run plans be potentially viable in that same way if you're using that instrumentality? And then can you get a private letter ruling like you do with the IRS if you're trying to figure out if a thing that you're doing as a tax-exempt entity is okay? And is that, therefore, something that we pursue next, get a private letter ruling on what might work, and do we join forces with some of the other states that sounds like all of which are also wondering the same question so that we can get a determination that everyone can work with?
Well, I think, Joe, if you can talk about the advisory opinion route, maybe that would be helpful, the last part of your question there.
Help me.
Or I will. So there is a mechanism for requesting an advisory opinion, and in the regulations it's detailed out what you need to, you know, under what circumstances they will in fact issue an advisory opinion. I think if it's too speculative, I don't think they're going to weigh in. It's got to be pretty solid facts and circumstances that they can look at and opine on. There is that route. It is called the advisory opinion route, but again, if it's too speculative, I'm not sure that they would be in have the ability to be able to give you an opinion.
May I ask a follow-up? Has anyone sought that? It sounds like there are some states that are even further down the road than we are in exploring these questions. Has anyone gone to, is it the ERISA board? Is that the entity yet and asked for that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm from the Seattle office. I can ask Joe on that. It sounds like we probably lost him. I can ask him. I'm not aware. For instance, the state of California he mentioned was furthest along.
Yeah. So it's not the ERISA board. It's the Office of Regulations and Interpretations, and that's their job.
And Mr. Canary is the chief of that. So
okay.
So it's simply a request with enough facts behind it to the Office of Regulation and Interpretations, assuming that there's enough facts there, they might be able to issue an advisory opinion. I'm not aware, though, that the state of California has come forward and requested that, or if they had, if there'd be enough there for them to be able to issue an opinion.
Too many what ifs.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's.
So I heard California's folks, and maybe somebody could correct me if I didn't hear correctly. I heard them say they needed to raise $1 million in order to pursue these ERISA questions and other Department of Labor issues. I also heard them say they would be more than happy to have states team up with them. We had sort of a sideboard after. And since we're all looking at some of the same questions and there's other states that are jumping into the mix as well, it makes sense to coalesce and figure out what the asks actually are before we approach the board.
Can we see if Joe's still on or not?
Joe, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Did you want to chime in on that?
I'm sure. I'm not sure I heard quite all of it because I think my connection is maybe not as good as it should be. But we have had informal conversations with the people in California, and I think the people that I've dealt with have been very knowledgeable, have put a substantial amount of time in to study their program, and also have a pretty good understanding of the ERISA issues. So pursuing discussions with them would seem to be a prudent step to be able to get the benefit of the work they've already done. Your program may take a different route, but I think there's a fair amount of knowledge there. I don't know about the $1 million issue in California. I think that if I understand their legislation correctly, there may be some requirement in their statute that the program be sort of financially self-sufficient and not be a charge against the state budget. So that may be a unique element to the way that they put their program together that would not be potentially relevant to what you're doing. In terms of general areas of examination, thus far, and you may come up with a different or more creative approach, the states have been looking at putting together programs as basically state-run programs, where it's a state program, kind of like maybe a state Social Security, where there isn't an employer involved in running the plan. The employers may be taxed, or some other way of generating revenue is used by the state to fund its own program. And then that program is used to provide sort of state benefits to, you know, the members of the state population that are eligible for the benefit program. there are probably examples like that if you're getting into sort of workers' comp, disability insurance, unemployment insurance programs that are run at the state level. They, in some cases, can be run as state programs. Other times, the state runs them to rely upon the employer establishing the employee benefit plan. And there are ERISA preemption issues there. You may want to talk to people in your own state to deal with disability insurance, workers' comp, and unemployment comp programs to see how they've run them and what their experience with ERISA is. That may not be directly relevant to you, but it might be helpful. But that's one group where they're saying we're going to try to look at this as a state program where we're really not involved in establishing an employee benefit plan. We're involved in running a state benefit program. An example of where that was explored is the San Francisco healthcare litigation that went up to the Ninth Circuit. I know that's your circuit. It's a welfare plan or group health plan case, but some of the issues that were presented in that kind of a structure were discussed by the Ninth Circuit. It did not go to the U.S. Supreme Court, so you may not have sort of the final word, but the Ninth Circuit is a very high level of federal court involvement. Another approach that some of the states are exploring, I think was one of the questions, was talking about simple IRA plans. It's really looking at arrangements that would be voluntary, that would not be funded with employer contributions, where it would be only funded by employee, potentially payroll withholding contributions, where the employer's involvement would be very limited, basically limited just to making its payroll system available and distributing information to employees that the state or the sponsoring state entity may prepare. The deciding line there is trying to figure out a way that the state could require that the employer make available a program without having it treated as being a plan, quote-unquote, established and maintained by the employer. And we do have a regulation, I think one was talked about it, they tend to refer them as safe harbors, for payroll deduction IRAs, where if the employer's involvement is very limited, there can be a payroll deduction IRA system made available through the workplace where the employer would not be establishing an ERISA plan. Some of the states have been looking at that kind of an IRA structure and trying to see if they can create a state program that's modeled on that, but does not have the employer involved to the point that you have the establishment of an ERISA plan. If you want to get some additional material on that, I think the state of California with its program solicited public input on its program and comments from employer groups, industry groups came in, academics, and they posted those comments on their website. That may be worthwhile looking at as well.
Could I ask a follow-up? That's a great answer, and I appreciate it. Does it matter who manages the assets under ERISA, for example, on your second example there, the simple IRAs? Does it matter who manages the assets under ERISA?
Probably, as with many issues in ERISA, there's probably not a totally straight answer to any question. Generally, the answer would be no, it doesn't. The way that many ERISA plans are established, they end up with third parties, banks, insurance companies, trust companies, holding the plan's assets. You may then have an investment manager, a third-party administrator that then is responsible for investing the assets, managing the assets, running the benefit claims procedure, dealing with day-to-day reporting and disclosure. So the employer may be sponsoring and may have established the program and then engaged a variety of third parties with different skills and expertise to then help run the program. The way that ERISA operates is the plan is the central element that creates the ERISA coverage. Once you have a plan, all the parties that are dealing with the plan, that are providing services in the plan, they become either fiduciaries because they're managing the plan or handling the plan's assets, or they're going to be service providers. And depending on the status, ERISA will impose very strict requirements on fiduciaries in terms of being prudent and loyal and not engaging in privileged transactions. And service providers that are not fiduciaries still are subject to ERISA requirements in terms of not engaging in privileged transactions, but they would not be fiduciaries to the plan. So those parties that are managing the assets, they may be service providers or fiduciaries to the plan that are subject to regulation under ERISA.
Or state IT problems?
No, it's the NSA.
The plan itself.
All right. Thank you. And I'm sorry we're having a little bit of problems with the phone. Are we cutting out when we talk to you? Can you hear us okay?
Well, it's very soft.
All right. Yeah, speak loudly if you ask anybody on the phone.
Given what you just responded about who could manage the funds, let me ask if that would include a governmental agency if a private sector program was developed, and could it contract with a governmental agency to provide that kind of management of and investment of the funds?
Well, that's one of the central questions some of the other states are looking at. From a purely ERISA perspective, the definition of who's a fiduciary does not have an exclusion for governmental actors. So to the extent that a governmental entity was managing the plan's assets or running the plan, just from a purely technical definitional perspective, there would be nothing that would say that that person would not be an ERISA fiduciary, the person or entity. I think that the issue that comes up is when you're talking about sort of federalism, sovereign immunity, and the consequence of attempting to apply a federal statute to a state actor when the state is engaged in performing some services in connection with the plan. Personally, I'm not aware of a lot of case law where that issue has been presented, but at least at one level there'd be nothing that would say that state actor or governmental actor would be free from ERISA regulation if they were sort of providing asset management or other services to employee benefit plans that are sponsored by employers.
But it would be free from the same kind of arrangement, or it would be free from not or from the requirements that might befall it if it were providing that service for government for employees of the government. Am I understanding that correctly? And there are certain regulations that would apply if it was providing those services for employees of the government. But if it were simply contracting with a private entity to provide those services, it would be subject to the fiduciary requirements, potentially, but not necessarily to any requirements, since those employees would not be its employees.
If I have it correctly, I think that's right, but let me rephrase it to see if I have your point correct. If there's a governmental plan, then an entity is doing something for governmental employees, and some of the states, I think, have probably very sophisticated expert administrative and other providers that are providing services to their governmental plans and doing a very good job of that. And part of the thinking, at least in some cases, is trying to figure out whether there's ways to leverage that and have that expertise used to then provide services more to the private sector in connection with private sector employees. If you're dealing with just a governmental employee, ERISA, and a governmental plan, ERISA does not apply at all. So there is no question of being responsible under ERISA. It would be a question of the state law and the state requirements that apply to that state program. If that state entity were then trying to say, well, let's broaden this out and create maybe a sub-arrangement or a parallel arrangement where it would run parallel to the state program, and the state entity that is already providing all these services to a state plan would provide it to maybe a collective plan for private sector employers, potentially small ones, maybe not-for-profits, depending on how you're defining the population you're trying to benefit, and then say we're going to run that as a parallel program, I think that's where your ERISA issues would be presented.
Yeah, I'm asking something sort of in between. If there's a private sector plan created or opportunity created, and that private sector arrangement, like in California, they created a separate board. If that board said, well, we want to do a request for a proposal for somebody to manage this, whatever we collect, what would happen if a request for or a response came from a state investment entity that said we could take that contract, and it was, would that create an ERISA connection?
Well, not in and of itself. You have to first have the plan, and I think California is trying to explore, if I understand it right, the payroll deduction IRA safe harbor and use an IRA-based program, and they're trying to establish something where there's the underlying arrangement would not be an ERISA-covered plan. And just, although it's different in terms of concept, it's the same in terms of result. If you don't have an ERISA plan, either because you have a governmental plan that's not subject to ERISA, or you don't have an ERISA plan at all, then the state's involvement is not going to generate ERISA issues. The challenge is, in light of the breadth of ERISA and the intent of ERISA to be a very prophylactic, broad protection for employee benefit plans, trying to find the space where a state could have a program where you're not going to have some ERISA plans and therefore ERISA requirements attached to the plan and to service providers.
So can I just, because Joe, you said this a few times this Harley Spring, you say that the term protection, and you know, ERISA is very complex and we all seem to have a tone of negativity towards it, which it's actually a really good regulation for participants and employees. That protection is for the employees and participants. When you're
right. I mean, ultimately, it's a system that's designed to provide requirements for running plans to make sure that the plans are run properly and the benefits that are promised are secure and provided in accordance with the law and the terms of the plan.
I have a question. Is DOL currently looking at enhancing the fiduciary responsibilities for those selling retirement plans?
Probably not specifically focused on people who are selling retirement plans, but there is a regulation on conflict of interest among parties that may be providing investment recommendations for a fee, and that may include activity that you might characterize as selling the plan.
Okay.
And that's a regulation that has been actively on our agenda for quite some time and tends to be a high priority for the agency. But if you want information on that, that's probably a different discussion. We do have a website where the proposed regulation, all the public comments, there was a public hearing on that regulation, and various sort of related information is posted where we can give you access to that if you were interested in looking at more background on that rig project.
Thank you.
Well, I think we really did reach the end. We saved the governmental plan for last. So we are done with our presentation.
Yeah. Great. Any further follow-up questions, thoughts? Excellent. Yeah, go ahead, please.
One quick follow-up. The simple plans as they now are written, and I administer a couple of them because I was a salesperson working with it, the employer matches to a point normally, and the employee doesn't have to put anything in. Sometimes they can put more. The caps are there. It's simple. It's not why they call it a simple plan, but it is simple. as a provisions, or do the same thing if the employer, I went to an employer and said, you don't have to do a thing except mail in a check. And this entity, bank, insurance company, whatever, mutual fund purveyor, would simply make a contribution for those who voluntarily want to sign up and put into it. Would that come under ERISA or not?
I'm hearing two questions there, so let me see if I'll talk through both of them and see if I've got your question in the answer. Simple plans were created by Congress, and there's special provisions in ERISA. There has been sort of over the course of time, and with the recognition that some of the ERISA requirements can be complicated, to develop simple, especially pension plans, retirement savings vehicles. The simple was one that was created probably most recently. There's a simple 401k structure, and there's a simple IRA structure. Before that, there were things called SEPs, or Simplified Employee Pensions, that were sort of a predecessor to the simple. All of them have special provisions in ERISA. The simple IRA plans in particular are in Section, I think, 4 of ERISA, where the Congress said these arrangements are going to be IRA-based and they're going to be subject to certain simple requirements, where Congress set them forth and said the rest of the more complicated ERISA requirements would not attach. So the short answer is the simple IRA programs are subject to ERISA, but they've got special rules to make them simpler.
Thank you very much.
The other question I heard was, so what if there was an arrangement that said all the employer has to do is cut a check and send it to an insurance company, a bank, or some other party, and that they would take it from there and do everything else that was required? At least from my perspective, probably is not enough to get you an answer to the question. If the employer is making contributions into the arrangement, that, from an ERISA perspective, is a very big indicator that the employer is establishing and maintaining that plan. It is funding the plan, even if there is a third party that is doing all of the administrative work in running the plan. And once the employer is treated as establishing the plan, then they can't just set it and forget it. They then have to engage in some oversight and monitoring, because the employer would typically be a fiduciary of some sort in connection with that plan. So although the concept may be attractive to say just cut the check and some other party will be responsible for it, if you've got an ERISA-covered plan, that is not possible. The employer is not supposed to do that. There are some things that are being worked on in Congress at the federal level, dealing with something called multiple employer plans, where there are bills pending, where Congress is trying to create new arrangements that may have some of the feel of what you're talking about, that the employer's responsibility would be focused on making contributions, but then some other party that may be licensed or qualified would be the party under the statute with many of the obligations to satisfy ERISA or the requirements that would be established in that federal law. You may want to take a look at some of that activity just to see what's going on. One of the big differences are that ERISA does not preempt federal law, obviously. So if Congress creates a new system, ERISA does not preempt it. The states may run into ERISA preemption problems if they try to copy what the federal Congress is doing. Hopefully that was responsive.
Thank you.
Can I ask Judy one other question? So earlier you used the words a few times, plans, fund, or program. Is there a reason why you chose those words?
Those are the words from the statute.
From the statute, actually?
Yeah.
Thanks.
And maybe either of you could answer this. When you were describing that ERISA also covers employer groups or associations, and then made reference to how members are solicited, was the term member something different than participant? In other words, was member an employer member of the group, but the participants are the employees. So there is a distinction. Am I hearing that right?
Yes, I think when we're talking about members, we're generally talking about the various employers that are signing up to participate in the program, the benefit program.
Like the Grocers Association or something like that.
Right, correct.
I have a question about voluntary, that it's voluntary for the employee. If you have payroll withholding, but you have an opt-out procedure, would that be considered a voluntary for the employee?
This is Joe Canary again. We have not answered that specific question. If you're things like automatic enrollment in an IRA kind of a program, I think California is looking at that. But the department has not specifically answered that question. As it relates to coverage, there are some provisions that the Internal Revenue Service has put out dealing with automatic enrollment in 401k plans and 403b arrangements where they've said you can have that kind of opt-out under the right circumstances and not be treated as a quote-unquote election by the employee to participate. The department has not reached that conclusion or really any conclusion on automatic enrollment in IRA programs. However, the way that the safe harbor is written, that would be a type of employer involvement that would be more of an indicator of the employer having a plan than if it really were an opt-in where the employee had to choose to participate rather than choose not to participate. So I think there are some concerns that automatic enrollment or opt-out kind of provisions may not fit under the payroll deduction IRA safe harbor. But as I said, I don't think the department has officially answered that question.
I do.
Well, are you distinguishing between, in the question that you were just answering, one where the employer makes no contribution or the employer makes a contribution? Does it matter either way?
If the employer makes an employer contributions, then I think you'd have another major indicator aside from the opt-out of the employer having established a plan. So even where you have only employee contributions but automatic enrollment, I think that is a type of structure that we have not addressed. But I think you'll see the commentary out there raises concerns about that being a type of employer involvement that would go beyond what we have said can fit under our safe harbor and avoid a risk of coverage. But the department has not answered that question. So short answer is no, I really wasn't distinguishing. But if you had employer contributions, you'd have other reasons for there being evidence that you have an employer establishing a plan.
Will the agency address that question? Has it been put before them, before you?
Well, there's an advisory opinion process, which I think someone mentioned earlier. So if you'd like to have the agency address that question, there is a way to sort of frame an advisory opinion request and have that submitted to the department. The department, I think, has an ERISA procedure 76-1 that sets out how you go about requesting an advisory opinion. And it is ultimately discretionary. The department isn't required to answer because someone asked the question, but there is a process to go through if you'd like to pose the question. And many parties will engage in pre-submission discussions with the department just to explore the issue and try to get a sense of the likelihood that they would be able to get an answer or a favorable answer before they put the time and energy into framing the request.
Got it. Thank you. That's helpful.
Oh, do you mind? Two questions. One, what is the rough cost of seeking an advisory opinion? I know with the IRS it's like at least a $10,000 proposition, but is there a ballpark figure for opportunity cost there? And then also, how binding is it? Is it just, kind of best guidance until some point at which there's a formal decision made elsewhere?
Right. There is no user fee or charge similar to what the IRS charges for an advisory opinion request. So there isn't like a fee paid to the government to make the request. the expenses are really associated with putting the request together, and many people will use an ERISA lawyer to help them put those requests together. So you may have your own sort of costs associated with putting it together and then engaging in discussion with the department during the course of the consideration of the request. I don't think I could probably give you an estimate as to what that would be. It would depend on how you go about it, which orders you use, that sort of thing. Your second part, advisory opinions are not intended to be sort of precedential. They're not binding in the same way that a regulation would be binding. They are supposed to be an expression of the department's opinion as it applies to a particular fact pattern, but they do not have the force and effect of law. So people sometimes ask for advisory opinions and they don't like the answer, and then they disagree with the answer, and then they will pursue their activities based on their view of what they think the correct answer is rather than the department's view. That creates risks. Then people say, well, I know the department disagrees with me, but I'm going to act in a different way, which may result in them, from our perspective, violating the law. That may create enforcement issues. But technically, the advisory opinion is not binding, really, on anyone. It is an opinion letter.
But how often are advisory letters overturned? That's the...
not too often.
Oh, good. That's good.
Right. I think we try to be very careful when we're issuing them.
Good.
Duke has one more.
Yeah, and Judy, I think you, if I captured this correctly when you were describing safe harbor, I think it was you, it might have been Bill. Safe harbor would be that the participants are... employees are the participants. It's the rights under ERISA are enforceable solely, rights under the program are so enforceable solely by the employee, that the employer's involvement is minimal and there's no financial benefit or return to the employer. Did I capture that?
Pretty fairly. We were talking about 403B plans specifically. Okay. And a regulation that provides a so-called safe harbor from coverage under Title I. And so if you met those factors, which one of them was the rights of the contract, the annuity contract, have to be enforceable solely by the employee. So it's not necessarily the rights of ERISA. It's the rights under the contract are enforceable by the employee rather than the employer. Okay. Then that's one prong.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Did anybody have any other follow-up questions? All right, Judy, Bill, I want to thank you very much. And, of course, on the phone we had Joe, Susan, and Hillary. I want to thank you very much. This is extremely helpful to us and very enlightening. And we appreciate your taking the time out of your busy schedules to come and help us. And my suspicion, based on the dialogue, is we'll be reaching out to you again.
So feel free.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wait, is this the hang-up? Okay, good. Call ended. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you all.
So item number two on our agenda, the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. That's a deferred comp plan for eligible government employees that we have here in the great state of Oregon. And we have Galen Bath, who is the manager of that program, here to tell us a little bit about it today.
Yes, and thank you for asking me. I wanted to just give you a little bit of background on why I got interested in this task force. I came to the very first meeting, our director, the Oregon Savings Growth Plan is under PERS, which is a public employee retirement system. We are a voluntary supplemental 457 plan, non-ERISA, but Paul Cleary brought me to the first meeting when Teresa Garviducci was here, and AARP, and a couple others. And so I sat in on that, and I just found it very interesting, and I liked the whole concept of providing a retirement plan for those private sector employees who don't have one. Because we find that even with our plan, it's hard to get people in the plan, even though we provide a lot of education, it's payroll deduction, it's a great plan. And so I know it's very difficult to get somebody to go buy an IRA or get into an IRA when they don't have an employer-sponsored plan. So anyway, Jan asked me to kind of give some background on the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and then talk to you about auto enrollment. I've done a couple of surveys. Very interested in auto enrollment. And then we have local governments that can participate in our plan, and I wanted to talk about how that works as far as payroll, because I've heard that question come up about how the employers are going to get that money to whatever plan might be, you know, the end result of this. So I'll just start. I've given you probably more information than you'll ever need on the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. It's our history, and I keep that updated for our PERS board. They are the trustees of the plan, and so we update them about on an annual basis. An asset report that shows that right now we're at $1.6 billion in the plan. When I was started about 10 years ago, we were right around $680 million. So it's grown quite a bit, and that's even with a huge drop in 2009, back down to about $725 million. It's come back very well. We have approximately 25,000 participants, and that includes state employees, higher ed, miscellaneous agencies, and then local governments who adopt the plan, and they have to go through a contract procedure. Their governing body has to adopt the plan, and they take on some fiduciary responsibilities, and our record keeper actually has a separate trust for each one of them. So we have over 230 trusts, I believe, with our record keeper for our local governments. And then local government would include cities, counties, special districts, school districts, and community colleges. So we have about 36% of state employees that are enrolled in the plan, which I think is really low. And so trying to increase that participation using various kinds of communication, especially with younger people, finding that they don't want to get something in the mail, they might read an email. That's been probably the most effective, but I'm trying to work with maybe some new technology and getting things so it's easier. A lot of people don't want to fill out a lot of paperwork and do a paper enrollment form and then mail it in, and they want something that's quick and easy. And so some of the obstacles I run into are, you know, can we accept electronic signatures, for example? That's, you know, I think revenue does, but I don't know if other agencies are even allowing that, which would make things a lot easier. And then auto enrollment, which I think would be great. You may know that auto enrollment for, I think with the Pension Protection Act, that's when auto enrollment came up. And I'm fairly confident, I could be wrong, that ERISA plans and private sector, they can offer auto enrollment to their employees. But public plans cannot at this point in some states because of garnishment law. And Oregon has a garnishment law in place. And several years ago, Representative McPherson introduced a House bill to try to get that law changed. And I've held on to it because I keep thinking somebody else might try it again. When I sat in on one of the hearings, people were concerned. I think it was a union representative maybe were concerned that, you know, you're starting people at these wages, they're low, and you're going to take more money out of their check, and they didn't really bring up the fact that they could opt out of it. And I think that's an important thing to stress, is that you're not forcing anybody to do anything. You're actually, you know, giving them, if they don't want to do it, they can opt out. It's a very easy, simple procedure. So I'm hoping at some point we can get, you know, that law changed down the road. Unions, through their contract, could use auto enrollment. In fact, Multnomah County, one of their unions did. I don't know how big the union was, but, you know, so I would like, you know, if SEIU did something like that, that would be great, because at least we could auto enroll union employees. One of the things that I provided are some surveys that I did of state employees, and this email went out to all state employees, whether they were in our plan or not. And I actually got a pretty good response the first time, like 4,500 people. The majority of them thought auto enrollment sounded like a pretty good idea. I think it was 61%. The ones that didn't think it was a good idea, some of them were pretty vocal, and I did put some of their comments in my summary, and not all of them, but some of them, and a lot of them were just concerned that we were being too paternalistic, that we were kind of taking their, you know, I think they also got concerned that if we made this auto enrollment, made this plan too easy to auto enroll in and everything, it might be easier for the DB plan to go away, and that's a big concern because we do have a pension plan, as a public employee, which is really nice. So I went ahead and did another survey recently. It was part of a larger email that had other things to do with the Oregon Savings Growth Plan that went out to the same email list, but I only got about 343 responses. Of those, again, the majority liked auto-enrollment, and this time they even liked re-enrollment, which would mean re-enrolling all of those, that 62% who are not in my plan, that you would re-enroll them in the plan as well, put them in a target date fund or something. So I was surprised that, they liked that idea. Some of them weren't too favorable when it came to auto escalation, which is also pretty important if you're going to use auto enrollment, because if you start somebody at $25 a month or 1%, 2%, they may just leave it at that. If you do auto escalation, which again they can get out of it any time, opt out of, people tend to let it go up every year. So anything else? The local governments, I wanted to talk to you about that. Our local governments do have to adopt our plan. They're not automatically eligible for the plan. But once they are, we have some local governments who might have two people, maybe even one person participating, and their payroll sends our record keeper, actually, the money in about three different ways. One way is they might do a spreadsheet, Word document, it's got the person's name, their contribution, and their last four digits of their Social Security number once they've had an established account. That way they don't have to be sending the whole Social Security number. And they'll either mail that or with the check, with a hard check, right to the record keeper, which ING is our record keeper, or they will send the report, either again a hard copy or scan it or fax it and then push an ACH to ING, which is much more preferable than a check. Checks get lost. We've had that happen before. That puts, in our case, because they do have to adopt the plan and become fiduciaries, that puts some onus on the employer, if that check was lost and earnings were missed, that they could, possibly be responsible for that. So we try to get them to use ACH. The other thing that works really well is that our record keeper has a payroll program. It's very easy to use. It's on a secure website. The payroll person, once the names are in there and the contribution limits, levels are in there, they just push that to the record keeper every month. The record keeper pulls money from their checking account. If there's any changes during the month, like somebody changed their contribution or quit contributing or whatever, they would get a feedback report and then just change their payroll accordingly. And we would love to see everybody using that, but I think my point is that, even these smaller employers are able to get the money to the record keeper. And if it is a check, and then, which puts a little bit more work on the record keeper, whoever is handling, the assets and everything, there is a way to do that. Our plan is actually, and one thing I did want to mention that I forgot to say is our funds in our plan are overseen by the State Treasury and by the Oregon Investment Council, the same group that does the PERS. And so I work with an investment officer at State Treasury who oversees our funds in our plan, and we offer target date funds. We have eight core funds and a self-directed brokerage account. So we feel like we offer a little bit of everything to our participants. So, and
Do you have any sense of the percentages going either through the automatic check clearinghouse or checks or direct payroll through the ING payroll site? Do you have a sense of...
We do. We track that. It's one of our goals to get to at least 45. We'd like to see... We're only at 41% of people using either ACH or the payroll admin. And of the ones using ACH or payroll admin, most are using the payroll admin. And then, but we still have over...
But 60% of local governments are using checks,
yes,
still?
Yes. And we... and they give us different reasons. They say that sometimes the money has to come out of different pockets, so that they have to write checks. Some of them think there's more costs associated with ACH, which I don't I can't imagine, because I think writing a check ends up being pretty costly. So it is one of our goals to try to get everyone on ACH. And if that was something, you know, if this plan comes into place, I would think that should be almost a requirement. We require that now of any new local governments who sign on. They have to use ACH or payroll admin. So,
who absorbs the costs, the administrative overhead?
Of our plan?
No, at the payroll level, who's absorbing the administrative cost? Is it the local governments, the cost of processing,
yes,
and mailing checks?
Yes, they would. So they would, yeah. And so any costs that, I don't know if there's banking charges for ACH or, but they, yeah, that would be on them.
Okay.
But they don't pay, you know, the local governments don't pay anything to our plan as far as, you know, for us to administer, or, you know, to let them in the plan. Our plan is totally self-funded by the
participants. And that's slightly far afield for this work group, but it's just a point for further reference.
Oh, okay. And that's all I have, if anybody had any questions or anything.
I do. Yes. Bert first, and then back to Dick.
Yes. Ing is deciding and administering the plan as a third-party administrator.
Yes.
Now, nothing's free in this world.
Right.
It's a choice of mutual funds. Is there any way of figuring out how much it's actually costing from $1 million goes in, how much of that goes to administering?
Well, yeah, ING charges us an administrative fee for the record keeping. We have an administrative fee of our own that pays for my office, and then the investments, which we don't use any of the record keepers' investments, so they're all, like I said, chosen by the Oregon State Treasury. There are investment fees, and those are, you know, just depending on what they are. We list our fees out on our website, and I also have them in our enrollment kit. So they're basis points based on that, you know, investment. Each, depending on what you're invested in, it'll,
sure,
your costs are going to be different.
First,
we try to keep them low. We really do. So
I just marvel, because sometimes there is a whole bunch of fees and things that do come out to administer mutual funds,
right,
investment costs.
Right, and we do, and actually our state treasury, our investment officer, is looking at adding even more index funds to our lineup, so that we'll even lower the fees more than they are now. We feel like we have a very low fee program. So we have like 18 basis points for administrative fees. That's both ours and ING's, and then our investments run anywhere from 4.5 basis points up to probably 56, I think is maybe the highest, and that's for small, mid-size, or international, which tend to be a little bit on the higher end.
Dick?
Yeah, just to make sure I understand, on page 3 of your report, it says that local governments have separate trusts and must adopt the plan. I think you made a reference to that. That means the local government either has to take an affirmative step and say we're going to participate,
right,
in the plan, or because of a collective bargaining arrangement where there's an agreement, then they would. Do they make an application? How does that work?
We usually, either they contact us, or I have a local government representative who will contact them to see if they're interested in participating in our plan. A lot of the larger local governments also have, some of them administer their own plans, like Multnomah County did, and City of Portland, City of Eugene. But some of the other ones use us along with maybe another plan, like a separate ING plan or something. So.
And then for on the ACH or payroll question, a payroll person sits there, makes an entry for like direct deposit, mm-hmm, and that money is withdrawn from the employer's payroll bank account. If they're participating in this program, it's a payroll deduction, like federal taxes, for example, but
right,
it's a voluntary amount.
Right.
And then an electronic, they would access ACH again and say, send to this program all of that money for these people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you'd have a report that listed out, so you knew where the money went. And
But you're unaware whether there's an ACH access charge to that employer.
The employer, I'm not sure. I've had some of them tell me that they thought it was going to cost them more money than it was to write a check, so that was why they didn't want to do that. So, which is, again, like I said, I think it's much better to use the ACH because things do get lost in the mail, unfortunately.
You said only about 41%. Only about 41% today are using within your program?
41% are using the ACH or payroll admin, yeah, out of 221, I think, are participating.
Actually, that raises another quick question. The 41% of employers, but how many participants, employees, does that cover? Is that like 80% of all the employees or some other? I mean,
That's a good question, and I really haven't looked at that to see which, if it's, because we do have some of the larger local governments who are not using ACH, and they, so it could represent a large number of the employees. And we have had a couple checks lost, and the employee has called and said, hey, my contribution didn't go in, and that's how it was determined that the check didn't get to ING. So we really don't want to see that happen.
Well, 41% of the employers could represent some larger or smaller number of employees.
It could, yeah. And out of, let's see, local government, I'm not sure of the number. Do you know how many people, Kathy, are in the local government plan? We have, 25,000 total, about 3,200 local government employees. Mm-hmm. And they usually have other plans, so we don't see a large participation with local government. School districts are used to the 403Bs, and so they have their own thing, but...
You said 24,000, did you say?
We have about 25,000 participants in the plan. That includes retirees, too, who still have their money in the plan. So.
But you have to be eligible for, you have to be a state or local government employee that's eligible for PERS or who's opted out of PERS.
And you don't have to be a PERS. We do have some local governments who have opted out of PERS, and, at the university level, we have people who are in what they call the ORP, the Optional Retirement Plan, and they're eligible for our plan as well. And by statute, which this makes it kind of interesting, actually, OLCC store owners are eligible for our plan, mm-hmm. and that's through statute. So for right now, they're able to participate.
That's your job.
Oh, yeah, please. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm just looking to see. No, the only thing I can say is when we went to ACH with our company, it was going to be expensive, but what they gave us the option, or we can have this particular bank do our Visa transmittals, and then there was no charge for the ACH. That was their big deal. Otherwise, it was going to be more expensive than a check.
It was, okay.
But it was so much simpler for our staff to just have it all done that way and no lost checks.
Right.
So they were willing to negotiate.
And I would think with the plan that's being envisioned here that it would be easier if it was ACH going to, because I imagine there's going to be more than 221 employers involved. So. Anything else?
Any further questions? Anything for the good of the order? Thank you very much. That was a very helpful presentation. I'm glad you came back to give it. That's a good parallel for our conversation. So now is the time of the meeting that is everybody's time. We're taking public testimony. We have a number of people, I think, who are signed up. The first is Jody Weiser. Where is Jody? There is Jody. You know the routine.
I know the routine. For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, and I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. I'm sorry to get this to you electronically, but I was flying home last night from Chicago at 1:30. So I got it done this, actually, after I got the building. As we've said in the audience, one of the things we've noticed is kind of an energy that happens to the panel when there's a mention of some kind of tax benefit, whether it would flow to the participants, it would be some kind of participation, we'd use the tax credit to get employers to sign their employees up and start the program or something like that. And so we decided to share with you the kind of benefits that are already flowing to seniors, and most of it is regardless of their income level. So the first section, program benefits for those 65 and over, just looking at an estimate for 2015-17 based on Gregory Tooman's rough estimates that he gave it when he did the PowerPoint about that. We just doubled those numbers. And I communicated with him about whether that seemed like, you know, is that right for next biennium? And he said, yeah, I mean, those are really rough numbers. So go ahead and use it, but use them with caution. That's not a revenue projection or expense projection. And we didn't come up with any number for what the cost of subsidizing housing for those 65 and over would be. Then we looked at the tax benefits that go 100% to seniors. And some of it is federal law and some of it is state law. So if you make pension contributions, you don't pay taxes on them, that's costing us $1.1 billion or $1.2 billion. The fact that when people like me get Medicare, we get our medical care for free, doesn't matter what our income is, we don't pay any taxes on that benefit. It's like getting a check, really. So that's another $636 million. Under federal law, if we're lower income, we don't pay taxes on Social Security. But under Oregon law, we get to not pay taxes on Social Security no matter how wealthy we are. So the state is more generous than the federal government in that way. One of the things we couldn't change is the federal pensions because that's all part of the whole PERS disagreement, so that couldn't be changed, but it is fairly expensive benefit for seniors. The additional senior medical coverage that recently was changed, and so now it only flows to low and fairly moderate income. I would say $125,000 a year is more than a moderate income, but it doesn't flow to people who make more than that. My CPA said today, well, most of his clients no longer get to claim the Oregon medical deduction. Long-term care insurance you don't pay taxes on the money you spend that way. The extra personal exemption if you're 65 and over is only available for low and moderate income. And some retirement income for low-income people is not taxed in Oregon. In addition to that, there are three kinds of property taxes that flow to seniors, and mostly those would be lower-income seniors that cost local communities about $4 million. So the total is $3.2 billion of benefits. And of that, $2.5 billion is not related to need. You get the benefit no matter what. And we know from seeing the statistics for who participates in savings for long-term care insurance or 529 plans or most any of these things, it's usually most of the money comes from the top quintile, and even more so for the higher up the quintile you go. The smaller the percentage of people, the greater the percentage who participate. Because, for instance, when I was teaching, I also had other income, so I could tax advantage all the income that was allowed by law because I had other sources of income. I didn't have to live off my teaching income. And I did that. But it didn't actually benefit the state in any way. It didn't, except for the time value of money that benefited to me, that the state's not going to end up paying anything additional because I have less money or more money saved. And then there are other benefits. It doesn't add up to nearly as big a number, but all of the kinds of benefits that we give in terms of public assistance benefits, probably seniors participate in those at a higher percentage than many other income groups. But in fact, as you heard already, only 7.5% of seniors live in poverty currently, and that's the lowest for any age group. And so, you know, we probably get more of the mobile home people, and we get more of some of the medical stuff just because we use more medicine. But if we're 15% of the population and we use 15% of the services, that's only another $23 million. The reason I wanted to share this is, if we're looking for how to get people to sign up, and we're looking for ways to do that, and what can the state do to get them to sign up, then we need to pay for it out of the benefits we already offer. because there's a lot there. I would think probably the Oregon Social Security law, benefits law, would be the prime place to go at $500 million in a biennium. I think there are other things that might work better than that. As you heard when the gentleman testified, I didn't get his name, he testified that he is an investment advisor and there wasn't much money in it for him to get people to sign into these programs. And of course, that is why we work. And so instead of thinking that somehow we're going to get the investment advisor community to get engaged in getting employers and employees to sign up, what if we looked to the small business groups and made some kind of bonus to them if they got their employers and employees to sign up? For instance, if AOI or Main Street Alliance or the Farm Bureau or any one of those people, they had, you know, maybe there's some prizes that are given. If you get, whoever gets the highest percentage of your employers signed up, whoever gets the highest percentage of investment given over to the funds, whoever has the most innovative marketing plan, you know, they're, that might get employers or employer groups, whether it's the software association or whomever, to put some energy into doing this. Or alternatively, you could have a plan that would say, we'll give you $50 for every business you get to sign up. And then we'll give you another $25 for each of the years that they actually participate so that you get it going. And it seems to me that that would support the part of the business community we really need to support. The other alternative supports the financial community, which is not a community that's suffering in any way. A lot of these associations of businesses really could use that kind of support and having a product to provide. And so I think it's a direction to look.
Great. Thank you, Jody. Appreciate your testimony. Next up, is this a threefer here? Three people want to come up together, I think. Is that two? Okay. Jan Meekums and Zach Steele.
No, Steve. Yeah.
Steve, I'm sorry, Steve. And so is Zach here? Did Zach want to testify?
He had to leave.
Okay,
testimony.
Very good. I will take him off the list. Thank you. And again, if you could state your name for the record.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Wheeler and members of the task force, for allowing us an opportunity to talk with you today. I did speak just for a couple minutes on the first meeting of the task force, but I really appreciate, by the way, I'm Jan Meekums, the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. I really appreciate the depth and breadth that this task force is going to examine this very important issue. And it's certainly one that we appreciate not only for our employers, who many of them do not have retirement plans, but also for our employees. It also offers a lot of challenges to our small business community. And to give you just background for the record, NFIB has 7,500 small business members in the state of Oregon, across the state, every trade imaginable. Most of our employers have less than 20 employees. So this bill certainly is a bill that's on our radar screen and affects our community. We also have 350,000 members across the United States, as we're in all 50 states. And this is our 71st anniversary. So we have been working with small businesses, Main Street businesses, for a very long time. What I would just like to bring to your attention and then have Steve speak is that we polled our members 2 years ago on this issue. And I feel like we represented both sides, gave a very compelling position of why this is very important. And 88% of the respondents, which we had a good number respond, 88% of our responders said they were opposed to a state retirement fund. And only 4.5% said that they were in favor of it. And then I did another survey just recently with some of our more active members. And it was an interesting cross-section. I sent it out to about 40 of our members. I had 8 respondents. But it was a cross-section from auto sales to retail to service to services. And the years in business ranged from 14 years in business to 57 years in business. The number of employees ranged from 5 employees to 48 employees. Asked if they offered a retirement plan, 7 of the 8 said yes, 1 said no. And the last question is, what is your opinion? How would you feel about a retirement plan that was offered and by the state that you and your employees could participate in? And all 8 said they were opposed to it. So these are businesses that are actively have their employees engaged, 7 of the 8, but it's something that they feel responsible for. They don't feel like the state should take over this responsibility. And with that, just kind of laying the groundwork, I'd like you to hear from one of our members, Steve Faree, and just what he's doing and how he feels about if the state was to go in that direction.
Great.
And thank you for your time.
And thank you. And just so I don't forget, we also had testimony provided in writing by Zach Steele.
Yes.
Provided as his written.
Zach Steele is also an NFIB member.
Thank you.
Just starting a new business.
Thanks. And Steve, if you could just state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Steve Ray, and I'm the owner of Mr. Ritter Plumbing in the Portland metro area. I've been in business for 14 years, and we have 34 employees. I wanted to give you my insights on the establishment of the Oregon State Retirement Plan for the private sector under House Bill 3436. Our 401k benefit, because we do offer one, matches 50 cents on the dollar up to 5% of their pay. We've discussed a number of times about the reasons you should plan for retirement and invest your money. I have 8 of my 34 employees that are actually enrolled in that 401k program. I can assure you that it's really not about compensation, because my average compensation is from $65,000 to $85,000 a year plus benefits. So it's really not an issue of pay. It's really, in my mind, it's more about the education piece. And also folks are living paycheck to paycheck, even at that income level. Educating people about retirement and saving, you know, that's something really should start in our middle school. I think if we really want to try to improve the participation in retirement, I don't think it's a government-run program as it is. Maybe government get involved in helping the education process at an earlier age and teaching folks how to manage money and save for their future. For a lot of small businesses, they can't afford to offer retirement. If employees that work for those kind of for a business that can't offer a retirement plan, there are private ways to go about investing their money, and those businesses also create jobs. The other issue is kind of a point for me is really the sometimes I call it the lip service given to small business, and what I mean by that is the accumulation effect of fees and expenses put on the small business. As an example of paid sick leave to road user fees to fog charges to increasing minimum wage, all those in it by themselves may make sense on paper and may work out, but when you start the accumulation effect of that really puts a big impact on our small employers and a big burden for them. We don't need a small business does not need another program to administer. Okay, they'll have pages and pages to decipher and an attorney to help us cipher those pages. We have enough regulations. Okay, so for those small businesses that not provide a plan for their employees, it's not because they don't want to. Okay, it's because they really can't afford to. I know a couple of small business folks that they don't offer 401k, but they can't afford it. Is a real issue for them. It's not because they don't care about their employees. They really do. I provide 401k programs for my employees because I want my business to help people grow and prosper. We all want that for everybody. Okay, but you know, success means different things to different people. So I'd urge you to take a look, real close look at whether government should really be managing the private sector retirement piece. I think that really should be left to all the private sector employers. So thank you for my time.
Great. Thank you both for your testimony. We appreciate it. Next up, Sarah Misiewicz. Did I get that right?
Scott Mishavis, you were very close. Okay, I get the
so
all
close.
The time. Do I really have to try to say this?
And Chad.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Chad wanted to come. Chad Sherrill.
Sherrill,
thank you very much, both of you, for being here today.
Do you want to start?
Sure. And I'm sorry, just formality dictates if you just say your names again for the record.
Okay. My name is Sarah Mishavich. I actually work for AARP's national office in their state government affairs shop, and I chiefly am responsible for the all the states that are doing this concept, this private sector retirement concept throughout the country. And Chad, do you want to state your name for the record?
Sure. My name is Chad Terriel. I am the state president, AARP Oregon. It's a volunteer position.
Great. Thank you both for being here.
Sure. Thank you for having us. As was noted by the previous testifier, you also have testimony from us in your packet. So please do take a look at that. And there's a few pieces I'd like to just highlight and draw your attention to. I don't have formal remarks, but just so that you can be clear about the important points here. First and foremost, AARP has a group of specific traits that we think the task force should consider when they're promoting further action. Those, you can find them on page 4 of AARP's testimony. They include the power of default options and auto-enrollment, particularly because inertia really is the thing that's keeping folks from saving rather than an active decision not to save. A requirement for businesses of a certain size to offer payroll deduction, retirement savings vehicle. This is an approach Illinois is taking. If you're interested in it, happy to share more information. Right now, Illinois is considering businesses with more than 25 employees have to offer some kind of retirement savings vehicle at work, whether it be potentially an Illinois facilitated plan or any other type of plan. They will always retain the right to be able to create their own plan. Number 3, allowing for optional employer contributions. All of these things, I should note, are if they are within the bounds of ERISA, DOL, Treasury, IRS, we're completely aware that sometimes those conversations are going to be much more complicated. So these are the sort of 301, 401 college level class considerations, if you will. And then finally, professional money management and pooled investing. Obviously, we know that those efficiencies are very important for participants, and we would like the task force to consider those. Particularly, I also wanted to remind the task force that there are more than a dozen, in fact, closer to 20 states now considering this topic. I do have experience working with most of them, so if you have particular questions about what's going on in any of those states, I'd happy to answer them for you. Just to highlight 4 that I think are really important for you guys to take a look at, Illinois is really the state right now that's closest to actually passing implementation language. As I mentioned, it would be an auto IRA function, which would be for medium-sized businesses. They have passed it through the first chamber as well as the second chamber committee referral. They expect that bill to come up again in November, and things are looking good there. Again, I would also like to mention Connecticut and Minnesota. Those two states passed legislation during their budget cycles this year, and they're turning points in this advocacy because they are the first times that states have actually appropriated general revenue funds to this concept. Both states appropriated $400,000 to do a feasibility study, similar to what's being discussed in California. And finally, Maryland is really our first state to talk about an executive order. So they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, this kind of retirement security work, and we would just like you as a task force to consider all the possible options. Chad?
Thank you, Chair Wheeler and the task force. I just want to highlight a couple of Oregon-specific issues or statistics. We have approximately 500,000 members, 50-plus age group. We know financial security is the topmost concern for most of them. It should not be a surprise to any of you. AARP recently issued a report titled Middle Class Security Project, in which they concluded that there has been a progressive loss of middle class economic security over the past 40 years, and that it has affected people of all ages, and it threatens the prosperity of Americans. We are supporting the measure of creating some sort of economic security program for those who do not have automatic provisions for making security possible or economic savings possible, partly because we're not only concerned about the welfare of the seniors or the 50-plus, but also the children and grandchildren who may have to take on the burden of supporting the parents and, of course, their own economic well-being. The situation is even more critical when it comes to retirement security. As all of you know, Americans are not saving enough, or some very little, and Oregonians are no different. A recent AARP survey found that those between ages of 45 and 64 have less than $5,000 in savings as they approach retirement. Middle-class Americans who save really save because of heavy reliance on employer-sponsor-based savings program, 401k, 403bs, whatever. Work-based program has been effective and efficient method of promoting savings for retirement. There's wealth of information relating to that. I had the fortune of listening to a prominent author, in this case in March, a professor at Harvard, who pointed out that if you have a program sponsored by the employer with an opt-out provision, both in this country and in other countries, the rate of participation skyrockets. Some places it achieves almost 95% participation. Unfortunately, in Oregon, 50% of the workers do not have employer-sponsored savings plan. This is one area where we think you can make a difference as a task force. We also want to assure you that you have the support of the Oregonian. Recently, there was a survey done, which is in your package by DHM Research, that found 80% of the Oregonian surveyed support some sort of state-facilitated, voluntary, flexible, the list goes on, self-funded, and at no cost to the state. In other words, they believe it's possible, and you could assure, at least based on the survey, that there is an overwhelming support for such a program. You have a copy of the poll, and we have distributed that to all the state legislators. I know you have a tough task ahead of you in crafting a program, but we urge you to really create good public policy in the interest of the workers to help them save and provide economic opportunity for saving for all Oregon workers. That's all. Thank you so much.
Thank you both for your testimony. We appreciate it. Last but not least, is it Kent Smothers? I think I'm reading that correctly. Kent, are you here? Somebody who has a name that looks like Kent that isn't, that wants to testify?
I think that got on there by accident. I don't have any public testimony.
Oh, okay, great. So you're just checking in.
I just like my name being read out loud.
did I at least get it right? I did. Okay, good. Finally, I got one right. Any other public testimony? Anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair,
please, the forward meetings.
For noting that on the record that we received public testimony, and you have it in your packet, and it's available to the public on the web page, but it's from testimony from John Mangan representing the American Council on Life Insurers, testimony from Main Street Alliance submitted by Stephen Michael, testimony from Andrea Miller with CASA, and Sarah Basler with the Oregon Nurses. That is all on the public record. And then the next meetings?
Yeah, we've got meetings scheduled next on July 15th at 1 p.m. and the meeting subsequent to that, August 6th at 1 p.m., I assume that will be in this chamber.
Right,
if
in
not,
this
it will be publicly noticed on the state website. Thanks, everybody.
And she just handed out, I'm sorry,
yeah,
one more piece of testimony from the Urban League of Portland submitted by Michael Alexander for the record.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.